Well, slowly but surely, we continue to see signs of sports trying to return. Premier League with news out this morning that phase one is going to be in place. So small group training will start tomorrow. Anybody who's been to soccer practices knows about all the small group training that can go on. Well, that's a beginning sign as the Premier League starts to join the rest of the sports world, not just discussing, not just making plans, but putting concrete dates out there for return. This one step a little bit closer to that. We greet you with that news on a Monday morning as we welcome you to noontime on the East Coast and Lunch Talk Live on NBCSN. Mike Tirico with you. Show always available, as you know, via our YouTube channel at NBC Sports and also the Mike Tirico podcast, which we creatively named for the host of the show. A ton of guests coming up today. We love the guests that we have. We're going to hear from Kevin Harvick, who won the return for NASCAR, his 50th career victory in the sport. Steve Sands was on the ground covering the TaylorMade COVID driving relief for COVID-19, raised $5.5 million yesterday. Steve will tell us what it was like to be out at an event and also what it was like to see the players out there as well. Many of you watched The Last Dance wrap-up last night, and Jason Hare, the director of that terrific 10-part series, will join us here in a little bit as well. Also going to get you caught up on what the latest is in baseball. All of that is ahead to some of the weekend's visuals. And we actually had highlights from sports this weekend, kind of a new changed world since the last 9 weeks or so. The Bundesliga got going in Germany, odd to watch. First sense for a lot of us of what it's going to be like with no fans and social distancing, goal celebrations from a distance, but Germany's top soccer league got back going. We mentioned TaylorMade driving relief. Matthew Wolff and Ricky Fowler had a good run, but Dustin Johnson and Rory McIlroy won. McIlroy knocking it to about 15 feet on closest to the flag at 17. And the Real Heroes 400 at Darlington as NASCAR returned. A little bit of a bumpy ride at the very start, but for the most part, not too many cautions. And Kevin Harvick comes up with the victory in the race. And again, the Real Heroes 400, the name honoring the heroes, the frontline workers, and Kevin Harvick was a big part of that. Every driver had the name of one of those NASCAR, or one of those heroes on their car. NASCAR doing a terrific job with those connections. And I'll bring in Kevin right now and congratulate him on win 50. And Kevin, I'm going to start at the end with you. It must have been weird. You got out of the car and there was nobody there to cheer you. How odd a feeling was that after the victory?
Well, it really, for me, kind of put everything into perspective. And you know, I think as, a driver being in the car and all those emotions and everything that go with that, to get out of the car to pure silence was really a moment that, for me, helped me put it into how big of an event it was without the fans there. So, you know, I think as you look back on it and I see all the texts and I see all the different things that are happening today, it's just a huge moment for our country, for our sport, for the sports world. And I'm just honored to hopefully continue being a part of this as we go forward. Just want to thank everybody at NASCAR for everything and the teams for everything that they did to put this event on, because there's a ton of work that's gone into it.
Yeah, I want to get to some of that work in a minute, but I first want to mention Dr. Josh Hughes. He was somebody who you called out on social media as the pandemic was going on, one of those real heroes, one of those frontline workers. His name on your car, and you get the victory. If you can just shed some light on your friendship with Dr. Hughes and what you've been seeing firsthand through his firsthand experiences during this pandemic.
Yeah, well, Dr. Hughes, or Josh as I call him, he's one of my really good friends, and really from the very beginning of this whole pandemic, you know, he and I have been in communication. We actually ride our bikes together, you know, here in town, you know, just to get out and exercise. So, you know, to hear his, events that are going on in the emergency room and all the things that he's dealing with personally, I realized how big of a moment it was each and every time I spoke to him to really try to get his mind off of what he's doing at work, because he's fearful for infecting other people, his family, what was going on, looking for face masks there in week two of when everything was happening. We took a lot of face masks out of the race shops and he came and picked them up and delivered them to the people who needed them when, you know, they didn't know if they were going to be short on masks and how they were going to protect themselves. So the evolution of everything that has happened in his work environment, and to be able to be there as an as a friend and try to help him through getting his mind off of what he's doing at work, much like we did this weekend, and giving everybody a few hours to get their mind off of everything that they're worried about, was really, you know, I felt like, you know, my responsibility to help him as a friend and give him that relief for, you know, the hour to hour and a half that we were able to be outside and just riding a bike.
It's been great sharing those stories of the true heroes, and great that NASCAR and you put it in such a prominent way. And hey, you have such a personal connection with him. Makes it even more special that you won win number 50, which I'll get to, and the historic nature of that in a little bit. But just the experience from the motor coach to the national anthem that Darius Rucker was singing on tape to getting in the car. Was there any point where it then kicked in that it felt like a normal race at all?
You know, as you go to the event itself and driving down there, and for me, the anxiety of just really not knowing how it was all going to go, as far as the pre-race screening and what that was going to entail, how that was going to go, all that went very smooth. And once I was able to get in the racetrack and really get inside my motorhome and just start to think about what was going to happen on the first lap and how you needed to take care of the car and the things that you needed to do and the communication with the team pre-race as to how inspection was going and, you know, when the car was on the grid. But that anxiety kind of, you know, as the week built up as to, you know, what that process was going to be like. I didn't want to screw anything up or you know, make a scene of anything and just wanted to make sure I followed the protocol because, you know, as we've gone through these last few weeks and talked through all the meetings that NASCAR has had with the drivers, as we had more and more time to talk about it, you really start to realize the magnitude of the situation and how important it was to not only our sport, but the sports world in general, that we try to make this event go as smooth as possible.
Richard Petty said it, you know, there are so many sports watching NASCAR right now to see if you guys get it right and how it works. And there's so many fans who are available to watch, and that was a big benefit of it. As for the competition within the race itself, anything that was compromised because of all the precautions that were put in place?
Well, for me, I'm a guy that loves to have that personal interaction with my team, and not being able to read the emotion on anybody's face is just different. And, you know, being able to smile at somebody to show them, you know, that you appreciate what they said, or, you know, having somebody smile back at you to show you that they appreciate what you said is just different when it's behind a mask. So all that interaction is awkward, you know, at this particular time, just because of the fact that you want to send the right message to the world and the people that are watching that you know, you need to take the guidelines and things seriously. And so, you know, you're paying attention to how close you are. There's no real emotion, you know, behind you know, that mask because you can't see it. So it's definitely, you know, that interaction is very different.
Yeah. How many pictures have we seen on Instagram or other social media of people taking a picture with a mask on, like, and they'll say, yes, I am smiling. You just don't see it. And that is certainly missing in any of our interactions, let alone for you guys. Hey, Win 50, Ned Jarrett and Junior Johnson, those are some real, real names in the history of your sport. What does it mean to you to reach the milestone that they've reached, 50 victories in the Cup Series?
Well, I'm always very cautious in trying to analyze things that I do personally, just because I feel awkward doing that. But I think in this particular instance, when you talk about, you know, Ned Jarrett and Junior Johnson and those types of names, you have to kind of sit back and for me, I almost have to pinch myself, and just because, you know, those are people that have had a major impact on our sport. And you know, as you hear those names, sometimes I sit back and try to ask myself, you know, have you done what you needed to do in order to live up to the expectation of what those guys have done besides just winning 50 races? And so, you know, there is a responsibility that comes with all of that when you put yourself up next to names like that. And for me, that's a good reminder of making sure that you take seriously the responsibility of trying to make the sport better and move it forward, because that's what those names have done, and they're they're icons in our sport, and I'm personally, holding myself responsible to try to come close to living up to those expectations.
Well, you're tied with them, and you may break the tie in like 60 hours. You got to race again on Wednesday. Are you doing anything physically to try to get your body back ready to get back in the car and do another race on Wednesday?
Well, for me, it's trying to stick into the same routine. I'm a little bit sore today just from everything that we haven't been doing, you know, and that's getting beat around in the car. I've ridden my go-kart to try to, you know, get some of that, out of my system. But, you know, I think as you look at, all the events coming up, it's very important from a hydration standpoint and listening to your body. I learned that in my wrestling days, that you have to be able to listen to your body and give it what it needs when it's telling you that you need to pay attention. So, I'll go this afternoon. It's not raining here in Charlotte, so that's a good thing. And I'll take my 7-year-old on his daily run that he doesn't really enjoy that much, but it's a good way for me to just kind of recover and we'll get a little PE exercise in as well.
Well, congratulations. You can play the role of NASCAR Cup winner on Sunday, PE teacher on Monday, and get ready to get back at the track here 24 hours after that. Hey, congratulations, and congratulations to the sport, too. It was huge for golf and NASCAR yesterday to give people something and to almost put a template out there for how it can be done. These are the first steps, and for all of us who love sports, we appreciate everything you guys went through, and good luck on Wednesday.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
All right, Kevin. Thanks. Winner, NASCAR's return yesterday at Darlington. They're back at it on Wednesday. Steve Sands was out there yesterday with Dustin Johnson, Rory McIlroy, Ricky Fowler, and Matthew Wolff. We'll ask him what it was like after this. Well, we mentioned TaylorMade Driving Relief yesterday, $5.5 million raised. Seminole Golf Club, chance to see one of the gems of American golf, ranked 12th in Golf Digest list of the best courses in America. And Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson at the end, because Rory knocked it close on the playoff hole, closer than Matthew Wolff. They end up getting the most skins and the most money. The American Nurses Foundation, beneficiary of their $1.85 million. The CDC Foundation, $1.15 million. As well, plus a lot of other money raised, $2.5 million more. Steve Sands, our colleague from Golf Channel and NBC, was there on the ground doing some interviews at Seminole, and he joins us now back in his home in Central Florida. First off, let's forget the golf part. What was it like to go back to work, which you haven't done in 9 weeks, and be around other people, all of whom had been tested within that weekend and had tested negative, thus were allowed to work? Was it strange at all?
It really was kind of strange. It was great, Mike, to be back after 9 weeks away. I mean, I don't know about you, but boy, have we missed sports in this house. It is, it's been a massive void, not only the way we do it for a living, but also just enjoying it as a viewer. But it was cool. I mean, everybody got tested. We all got tested multiple times last week. The players did as well. It was great to be around the guys. It was great to be around the officials. Great to be at Seminole, obviously. But just to get back at it, some semblance of normalcy. It was a really cool weekend.
And let's just stay on what people at home are dealing with. We'll get to the sports stuff. We got time here. Returning to work, Governor Cuomo is in his daily briefings talking about testing, talking about New Yorkers who were returning in phase one, go get tested. There are testing sites available. There's capacity there to get tested. Once you get tested and you're negative, doesn't mean you're not going to catch the virus again. You could very well catch it the very next day. So in the back of your mind, the mental part of returning, how easy, how tough from what you thought it was going to be like?
It was much easier than I thought it was going to be. I think once we got into the groove of our relative normalcy of what we normally do week in, week out, Mike, which you know very well, we've been doing this for a long time. What was strange was that it was such a small crew. We only had 28 people on the TV side. And as you know, Mike, our audience doesn't know this, and nor should they care. But we normally have well into the hundreds there, a big TV compound and trucks and trailers and all kinds of people floating around. It wasn't like that the last couple of days down in South Florida. So in that regard, it was very odd. But for the most part, it didn't take long for everybody, all the technicians, all the cameramen, the production manager, everybody on the staff, the couple announcers who were there, me and Jerry Foltz, to get back into our groove. It felt great. It really did. It felt really good to get back after it.
We keep talking about return to sports, so why don't we stay on that theme for a second. Just within the last 45 minutes, I mentioned Governor Andrew Cuomo from New York. He said that he's encouraging major sports teams in New York to reopen without fans, and the state will help that effort. So those continue to be the signs from the voices of leadership in this, and we had President Trump on from the White House yesterday. The White House reached out to the PGA Tour. The president wanted to be on the broadcast. We're a longtime partner with the tour, happy to help them in their request there. So we interviewed the president, and I asked him about what that might look like in a return. Here's what he had to say during our broadcast yesterday.
We want to get sports back. We miss sports. We need sports in terms of the psyche of our country. We want big, big stadiums loaded with people. We don't want to have 15,000 people watching Alabama LSU, as an example.
And that was talking about the want and the desire, but then there's the reality. Steve, to get 50 people total on the golf course yesterday with all that testing, we're a long time away from having fans return. What was the atmosphere like without any fans, which is the way we're going to experience sports for the next month or two or three?
First of all, being a company guy, Mike, it would have been nice if he would have chosen Notre Dame and Notre Dame Stadium as opposed to LSU and Alabama over on another network there in the SEC. But we digress. It was odd in a sense that it was quiet, Mike. I mean, I think that most people realize when you go to a professional sporting event, you're going to see people, even if it is a charity event. You're going to have thousands of people there. So in that regard, it was odd that it was quiet. But once the players started getting more competitive and people who were there on the ground, there were some security people, Jay Monahan, you mentioned him, the PGA Tour commissioner. There were a couple of other dignitaries, some people from NBC and Golf Channel on our side. And obviously all the people who were doing the telecast were there. When there were a couple of big putts made, I believe it was Ricky Fowler. I forget what hole it was when he made a birdie and he kind of stuck his hand out, kind of waving and pinching his hat like he normally would, and nobody was there. I think it's going to be a really big deal to not have fans when the PGA Tour returns, when sports returns. Yesterday, being at Seminole, small venue, only four guys, one group, Mike, it wasn't nearly as odd as I thought it was going to be.
It's interesting perspective and what we're going to get used to here going forward. I was interested in the president's comments, too. We asked about testing and testing of players and athletes as we also try to find enough testing for every American who's going back to work. And should pro sports athletes jump the line because of that? His response essentially was that there'll be enough testing for all of that to take place. We'll continue to watch that as we go forward. Steve, to the golfers themselves. So one thing that we cover all the time is the amount of money that golfers win and FedEx Cup points and all the things that come with golf. What we don't talk about often enough is the charitable donation that's left city by city when the tour leaves. The $5.5 million for the couple of charities involved yesterday, really, when you take a step back, kind of blows me away. 4.5 hours of golf, the guys give their time. And there's $5.5 million that the Nurses Foundation and the CDC Foundation would not have had if not for the golfers and those companies who supported the event yesterday.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I was talking to Jay Monahan, actually, on the 17th hole, that par 3, when they played in regulation, not in that playoff with the closest to the hole to win it. And we were talking about the $3 billion, that's B with a B, a billion with a B, $1 billion over the years raised for local charities by the PGA Tour. And it kind of dawned on me. Mike, you and I are huge sports fans. We've been very lucky to cover a lot of great events outside of this game. And no sport raises more money for local charities than golf. Right. No organization raises more money in sports than the PGA Tour. And the players give their time. It's just part of what they do. It's in the DNA of the sport and also the athletes who compete in it. And I've had many people ask me, how much money did the guys make yesterday? I said, they didn't make anything. It was all for charity. Right. It was all raised for those organizations that you said. And it's just one of the great things about the sport of golf that makes it unique to the other games. Not that the other games don't raise money like they do. They raise it in millions and millions of dollars, no question. But there's something special about golf, putting it together, Jimmy Dunn, the president, having it at Seminole, the PGA Tour players being willing to do it, They're donating all their time and their efforts. It was a pretty amazing collaborative effort from a lot of people to make yesterday happen.
Steve, it was really cool to see the guys in shorts and carrying their own bags, even little carry bags that they had. For me, every time I looked up, I'm like, that's odd, but it's really cool because that's what a lot of us do when we go out and play. What was it like to be amongst the group of four as they were doing just that, hit a shot and not just walk off, go back and pick up their bag before they go down to the fairway?
Well, in the locker room on Saturday afternoon, we had a meeting with the players, the PGA Tour rules official, those of us on the TV side, we're all in this meeting. And Dustin Johnson said, man, I can't remember the last time I carried my bag. McIlroy said, well, wait a second. I carry my bag when I go back home to Northern Ireland all the time. Ricky Fowler said played last year just before the Honda Classic a practice round, and he carried his bag. So those guys are not used to it. We're not used to seeing it. I thought the relaxed look of shorts looked good for yesterday's event. I happen to be a fan, not to be too old school, but I happen to be a big fan of PGA Tour players wearing slacks because we aspire to be them on the golf course, and they should look different than you and I do when we go out and play golf. So the carrying the bag and the shorts yesterday I thought was a perfect touch for the way the day unfolded. I thought it was awesome. And the guys really dug it as well. And we were actually joking with Ricky Fowler coming up one of the holes late in the day. I said, man, Joey Skovron would kill to carry that small bag as opposed to the tour right. bag. Because those four guys yesterday, right. Mike, make no mistake about it, they were not about to carry that heavy tour bag whatsoever.
No. There were limited provisions in their bag for sure relative to what is normally out there. Steve, just to the golf itself, because Dustin Johnson and Rory McIlroy told us here on the show they hadn't played as much coming into this event. Matthew Wolf had played a little bit more. One thing that jumped out to me was Matthew Wolf may have been nervous. He may have had a moment or two of getting used to being in that circle with that spotlight. But his driving of the golf ball was just otherworldly compared to some terrific drivers of the golf ball.
Look, I'm sure you got plenty of texts yesterday and last night and this morning about the event. The most interesting texts I got were from some of the guys who play on the PGA Tour who just couldn't imagine where Matt Wolf was hitting the golf ball. He hit a 368 on 14, and the interesting thing is, he said, you know how they always tell you in golf when you're a kid all the way through an adult is don't swing hard, swing easy. That's the better way to do it. Right. And he told us on the air, Mike, if you remember live, that on 2 and 14, both of the TaylorMade long drive holes, when he was trying to rip it and swinging as hard as he could, it was the straightest he hit a golf ball as well. So maybe that's going to change the way he goes about his business on the PGA Tour. But I thought it was really neat to hear the guys mic'd up, to hear Matt Wolf admit at a young age and being the newbie in that group of very accomplished players with Ricky, Rory, and Dustin that he was nervous, he was feeling it, and he also admitted and realized that it was a big spot for him yesterday, and I thought he came through it very well. I think the world now knows that Matt Wolf is going to be a star on the PGA Tour as long as he stays healthy and focused. He's a terrific kid, Mike. You're going to really enjoy getting to know him.
Yeah, it was fun to watch him play. All right, so we're 3-plus weeks away from the Charles Schwab Challenge. That's a Colonial. As we wrap up, Steve, do you think that the other tour players watching this event last week, the event that's coming up this weekend with Tiger and Phil, and the sense of this is going to get real here in a couple of weeks, you think that they're starting to ramp up their preparation to get back for what's going to be a really significant run of golf here as long as things stay on schedule?
No doubt. If you go back to what you were talking about with President Trump, as the country opens up, I think more golf courses open up and the guys are starting to ramp up their preparation for the Charles Schwab Challenge, which begins, as you see right there, on Thursday, June 11th. I think those four events are going to be big, not only for the PGA Tour, Mike, but for sports. I think sports is going to look at golf the way it did yesterday and say, you know what? This game can happen responsibly. We can go out there and do it. We miss the fans. We want our customers back. But we also want to be able to play and compete and see the world's best players. The guys are jonesing to get out there. They cannot wait to compete. And by the way, Mike, you know who's going to be the beneficiary? Not only fans like us watching on television, But those tournaments mm-hmm. themselves, those four events, Mike, and I know you're close to the one in Detroit, the Rocket Mortgage, they're going to have the best fields they've ever had because these guys haven't competed in now 9 weeks, and it'll be 12 weeks leading up to Fort Worth. They are ready to go. McIlroy told us yesterday he's going to play the first three events. So for him to go to those three places, he's played Hartford before, mm-hmm. not Colonial and not the RBC Heritage. They are in for a world of fun in those communities to see the best players in the world compete at their events for the first time. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I know the event here, the event in Hartford, the Travelers, they've got some great things planned as well as the give back continues here with the sport as well. Stevie, great to work with you again yesterday, buddy, and thanks for having the Ovechkin drawing up behind you. You continue the Washington Sports Hall of Fame there in your house. We look forward to the Wizards room next time you join us.
Well, we were going to go with the Terps national title. That's over there in 2002. The Nationals wall is to our left. If we ever do this again, that's the reigning World Series champions. And we're just trying to channel our Ivor Robson from yesterday and try to move it forward, Mike. You did a fabulous job. Always great to work with you. Good to see you again.
Yeah. Same here, pal. Steve Sands proving that you can have a room of an eighth grader when you are. Bye, Stevie. When we come back, Rodney Harrison's going to join us. We'll talk football, a little bit of news with Aaron Rodgers this weekend, and some other things that are going on as football also makes an inch closer step to normalcy as the team buildings start to open. Rodney next. Stay with us.
Ready when you are. Yep. Middle long. Keep coming. Keep coming. Keep coming. Keep coming. Oh!
Let's go.
Dolphins sharing that on their Instagram. Mike Gesicki making a catch on a pass he threw himself. It's happened in the NFL. Quarterbacks throw it. It gets knocked down by the defensive lineman. They catch it. I think Brett Favre's first completion when he was with the Falcons was a play like that. So Mike Gesicki keeping us entertained. Maybe the player is actually going to get to do stuff within their team facilities coming up soon. That was some Friday news in the National Football League. I want to bring in our colleague from Football Night in America, Rodney Harrison, to talk about that and more. As Rodney, the slow steps of football returning give us a hint that things may be getting a little bit better. What would it be like for you as a player right now to be here in May, still not connecting with those new teammates yet, virtually trying to build those relationships going forward?
Well, I think you have, as an individual player, you have to put yourself in the best possible position. And what I mean by that is these virtual meetings, you can still get a lot out of those virtual meetings. The key is you have to make sure that you're attentive, that you pay attention, you write notes, that you do all the necessary things. I think the second part of that too is kind of what, as a player, what are you doing outside of those Zoom meetings and things? Are you calling other players? Are you communicating with other players? Are you making sure that you're in great shape? So as a player, those are all the things that you can do, but I still believe that you can get a lot out of virtual meetings. It's just a matter of how much effort you put into it as an individual player.
We've got a list of what the NFL is allowing teams to start doing that we'll put up here. And essentially, it's tomorrow. The big caveat is local and state governments have to be there. But they're phase one in the NFL. Consent forms, an infection response team. That's going to be big around the league for people who are experts in that area. An infection control officer and clubs having their own protocols in place. They've put those in place. It's been a long time since they've been back in the building. You've been there in May when these OTAs are going on and this important part of the season is happening. What specifically are teams doing at this point that really give you a chance to start from a better footing once you get to training camp at the end of July and August?
I'm not 100% of what the teams are doing, Mike. I just think it's one of those situations where you have to, like I said before, you have to put yourself in a position where you are studying, that you're communicating constantly with the coaches, that you're watching tape, that you're doing all the individual things that you can do as a football player to prepare yourself for the season. Because we don't know, I mean, yeah, they're opening things, but we don't know how these next 3 or 4 months are going to go. I had some meetings. I'm on the board of my local school my kids go to. And they were talking about possibly open up the school. And I'm like, hey, you know, how can you open up the school if you don't have a vaccine? So there's still a lot of questions going on and a lot of uncertainty as parents, as you know, let alone as a fan of the game.
Well, Rodney, you bring up a great point because baseball immediately for the summer and then football at the grassroots level, high schools, travel teams and soccer, all of those things. That's the next level of sports that maybe we haven't discussed as much, but is equally as important because of COVID-19, because you're exposing not just the kids who fortunately have shown a lower propensity to get the COVID-19 illnesses, but also the coaches who sometimes are older and sometimes are in that range. Hey, I want to spin this to Aaron Rodgers because Friday, Aaron did a conversation with the Green Bay media, a lot of national media on there after Jordan Love gets drafted in the first round. I read some of the comments from Aaron Rodgers. It just seemed like a very mature way of handling the situation. How much do you think the fact that he's lived through this once on the other side of it has helped him frame what's going on? And this is the quote we wanted to share. General reaction was surprise. Not going to say I was thrilled by the pick, but I understand the organization's not just thinking about the present and the future, and I respect that. Your thoughts on the way he's reacted to this?
Well, I think he's a little older player now. I think he understands that this is a business, but, you know, all players are paranoid. It doesn't matter your salary. It doesn't matter, you know, your resume, how many Super Bowls you win. When you draft a player that high, you know, eventually they want that young player to play. And I think it was a wake-up call for Aaron. I think it hurt his feelings ultimately because he felt like he did so much for the organization, and he felt like they weren't far away from getting to the Super Bowl. Add a couple pieces on the offensive side of the ball, his disappointment that they didn't do that, and they're right back in the mix. And I just think that Aaron Rodgers is looking at like, look, guys, I still feel like I'm in my prime. Why would you go out and get a young guy when we need help, you know, in different areas? And I also think it was a wake-up call. I think, you know, the Packers sent a message to Aaron Rodgers, say, hey, you know what? We know you're great. We know you're this and that, but now we have a younger guy. We're not looking for you to necessarily mentor him, but we got a younger guy that's going to be right behind. And if you ever slip off, we're going to go with the younger guy. I think it was a clear message sent by the Green Bay Packers to Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, and I think Aaron, his words just kind of gave you a sense of the way he's going to approach it and handle it. And he rarely needs motivation. We watched this Jordan documentary. We're going to talk to the director of that here in a few minutes. And you see how Michael found all these motivation moments in his life, slights, if you will. Aaron's great at taking those things and channeling them as motivation. I think you're going to see the best Aaron Rodgers you can see at this point in his career. Rodney, I'm wondering about the Patriots. Go ahead. Are you going to say something? Go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, I think, you know, I was with the Patriots when they drafted Brandon Merriweather, a first-round draft choice. Yeah. Anytime, you could be an excellent veteran player, but they're going to always try to get younger. They're going to always try to get cheaper, and they're going to always try to put that pressure on you so, you know, so you don't feel like you control the organization. It comes down to just, you know, making sure that you have depth on the roster. And I just, you know, Aaron Rodgers, you know he's going to be motivated by this. And, you know, everybody's going to be watching in the locker room how he deals with this situation. I think this is really going to be a turning point in his career, Mike.
Let me ask you about New England. You brought up New England. Leadership for that team. Obviously, Tom Brady's presence was so big, and you've told us about his leadership and the different ways he led. How do you think that team goes about finding the internal locker room leadership without Brady and obviously Gronk not being there, but he wasn't there last year anyway? Where do they find that as they look forward to this season of change for New England?
Well, this is the time right here. This is the time. All the guys that are volunteering, all the guys that come in, they do extra work once these facilities start to open. You start to really find out by a guy's work ethic, his commitment to the classroom work, how involved he is and everything that's going on around the organization. And then you start to see, you know what, this guy has been really consistent. Maybe we vote him a captain and a couple guys start communicating. And then before you know it, you have two or three or four leaders that emerge that normally wouldn't have been leaders. So I think the Patriots, that's the last thing that they're worried about is leadership. You got so many leaders on the defensive side of the ball. You got quiet leaders on the offensive side of the ball. And of course, you still have Bill Belichick. Mm-hmm. I think this is a team that's looking at a 10-6 record, maybe 9-7 at the worst case scenario.
Wow. Wow. That's higher than some folks think. Hey, before I let you go, Cam Newton's still out there. Nobody has signed Cam Newton as of yet. Are you surprised by that?
I'm not really surprised, Mike. I think that a lot of teams might be hesitant to see if he's able to accept that backup quarterback position job. You know, Cam Newton is a guy that's always been a starter. He wants to start. He wants to be on the football field. But if he's not willing to take up that backup job for this year, for 2020, I wouldn't think about signing Cam Newton.
Mm. Yeah, it'd be interesting just to think of Cam Newton, where he was and the impact he made, but potentially not being on a roster here when we get to training camp. All right, stay healthy. You look great, man. We'll talk to you soon. I like the look. You've kept it. It's pretty solid so far.
Hey, Mike, thanks, man. Great job on golf, too. It was nice having it back, brother. Appreciate you.
It was nice to be back for sure. Thank you, Rodney. Rodney Harrison, Football Night in America. All of us do NFL pregame shows over our time are thinking of the crew that really set the standard. And that was the NFL Today crew with Brett Musburger, Jimmy the Greek, Irv Cross, and Phyllis George. And all of us were saddened when we found out over the weekend that Phyllis George passed away. We wanted to share our condolences to Phyllis and her family as well. Phyllis was a pioneer. Glass ceiling breaker in so many ways, had a way about her, not just with athletes, but on the set with the guys as well. And at any time, and for those of us who were fortunate to be around her at different points, a respect for all of us who do this job, who owe a debt of gratitude for her and that NFL Today crew for how they set the template. We remember Phyllis George and her passing this weekend. We'll be right back.
Yes, sir, I'm from. Tiger, can you just talk about the dynamics of the Grand Slam?
I think if you could put all four trophies on your coffee table, I think you can make a pretty good case for that, too.
We'll never see a guy win a major championship by 15 shots again. No way.
The NBA always talks about trying to find the next Michael Jordan. We have him.
He was very clearly the singular force in sports.
People ask, yeah, you know, I remember Tiger doing that running point, and I was like, yeah, that was against me.
I remember having this conversation with a writer. I said, all right, let me explain it to you. There's never been a human that's ever done this before, so you call it whatever you want to call it.
Charmin always makes me laugh. The Tiger Slam, when Tiger had all four of the major championship trophies on his tape. We'll have that documentary for you Sunday, 8 Eastern, on Golf Channel. We look forward to watching that limited commercial interruption thanks to U.S. Bank. It's been a pretty rich time for sports documentaries about some of the greats of all time. And the man on the other side of the screen, Jason Ayer, just did an exceptional job directing The Last Dance, the 10-part Michael Jordan documentary that has aired on ESPN over the last 5 weeks. And he joins us now. Jason, did you sit back in those 2 hours when it re-aired, when it aired every Sunday night and just watch the finished product, even though you lived every frame and every bit of sound in it along the way?
I did, of course. And, you know, I was texting back and forth with friends and family and people who hadn't seen it. And then, of course, the team of us who made it, who have seen it, because it's kind of bittersweet for us to be done, but we haven't seen each other since Thursday, March 12th was the last time we were all in the office together. So this is definitely not the way we envisioned finishing it. But I was watching with everybody last night because I had never seen those episodes on a television screen. I've only seen them on the laptop that I'm speaking to you on right now because we finished those episodes in quarantine. So I've never seen those on any screen bigger than this little one right in front of me.
Having to rush the project to get it ready, to roll it out a little bit sooner because it was going to be around NBA Finals time, what did that do to the production team to try to pull everything together that you'd been working on for quite some time, and now you had to fast forward something that really is a highlight of your career works?
It was technologically, it was a big challenge because we had to go from a multi-million dollar facility into our own apartments. You can see here that this does not look like a multi-million dollar edit facility. And we don't have the same accoutrements that you would in a place like that. But we have brilliant technical people on our team, and we have world-class editors who happen to have world-class setups already at home. So we were able to go pretty much seamlessly and get just large hard drives full of thousands of hours of footage into our apartments. And then creatively, it was difficult because we used to, all these high points of the doc of any project are the product of an epiphany that you have in the room with the people you work with. Late at night when you're ordering takeout, someone has an idea, try this shot over that cut of music, and the ideas go from there. Well, that was gone now. because we're just on Zoom calls and emails and texts.
What do you think Michael thought of the finished product?
I have heard that he was happy with it. I can't say for certain because I haven't spoken to him or communicated with him since the last time I saw him, which was in December when we did that interview when he's in the black shirt. We shot that on December 10th, I believe, last year. But I've heard through a couple of sources that he enjoyed the final couple of shows.
What were those interviews like? Because there was the one that ended, I guess it's episode 7, where he was emotional talking about really the, if you will, the 2-minute soliloquy on what made Michael Jordan different. And then he said break at the end and he got emotional about it. What was the setting like as you guys were doing those interviews?
Surreal for that one when he first sat down, because this had been the product of 2 years of research and preparation to just get him in the chair for the first of what was 3 interviews. So it took me, you know, a solid 5 or 10 minutes just to kind of shake off that out of body experience of how am I sitting here talking to Michael Jordan for this documentary. But it's a testament to his charisma and his down to earth nature that pretty soon it's pretty easy to have a conversation with him. And I think that he respects people who have done their homework, and we certainly did our homework as a crew before that shoot. That moment that you just spoke of happened only 45 minutes into the first interview, and we got 8 total hours with him on camera, but that was 45 minutes in. And then I don't know if you remember from the first episode, I said to him that the Bulls were called the Chicago Bulls Traveling Cocaine Circus. And it elicited this laugh that I've never heard from him before. And all of the research that we've done and all the docs I've seen and the interviews that I've seen, I've never heard him belly laugh like that. So that was only 20 minutes into the first interview. So him laughing like that means that A, he's acknowledging that that's true and he's not afraid to show it. And then B, he took it a step further and offered us an anecdote about what it was like from his perspective coming from college to see that. Yeah. So it was very indicative very early on that he was in this for real.
Jason, a lot of these, you'll have somebody with a reporter, somebody who's been on camera a lot, do the interviews. You do all the interviews here. And one of the key things in any successful interview is connecting. Why do you think you were able to connect with Michael in a way that we haven't seen him connect with most other than Ahmad Rashad, really, or Quinn Buckner over time?
It's like I said, the research, I think he knew, and his representatives, his closest advisors, Curtis Polk and Esty Portnoy, had the foresight to put me in front of him a few times before we actually sat down. So I met him 8 or 9 months before we ever rolled cameras. So at least he knew me, he knew my face at least, and he knew that he could trust where I was going with this project. He knew he was in responsible, safe hands. And also, I don't think that we've seen him in this setting a lot. I think that's probably what he would be like with a lot of interviewers. That's his personality. He's a relaxed, fun guy to hang out with, very much a guy's guy, very much, you know, cracking jokes with the crew and cracking on them. And he appreciates it when you give it back to him. So he's an easy guy to get along with. And I think that you're seeing the real Michael when he's sitting in that chair just having a conversation with me rather than a quick formal interview.
All right. What's the big chunk of storytelling that you couldn't fit in that you wish you could have?
Probably his early development, both in high school and then in college and early in the pros. You know, you saw George Kohler, his personal assistant and best friend. Mm-hmm. And Michael was the one who insisted that he be titled that. And that tells you all you need to know about his relationship with George. He met George when he first got to Chicago when he was a rookie. He came off the plane and he couldn't find the car that was supposed to pick him up. And George couldn't find his fare who he was supposed to pick up. So George went up to Michael and said, hey, aren't you Larry Jordan? And Michael said, no, that's my brother. I'm Michael Jordan. It turned out that George had played ball with a guy named Larry Jordan, just got the name screwed up. But Michael wasn't Michael Jordan at that point. He was a famous college player, but he certainly wasn't a household name yet. And he ended up giving Michael a ride to his hotel for $25. And Michael tipped him and George gave him his card and said, hey, if you ever need anything in Chicago, need to know where to go, give me a call. So 2 days later, Michael calls George up because he needs to go find a place to get a haircut. And they've been best friends ever since. So there's little stories like that all throughout Michael's, you know, we had a lot of stuff about his childhood, about his high school career, like I said, about his decision to leave UNC and how much thought went into that with Dean Smith and his counseling. So there's a lot of that early stuff that I would love to have done, but we had to get through so much story with other characters as well.
It was massive, and the interviews were great. Phil Jackson, Steve Kerr. JC, you get up on a mountain here with your work, and you have, because this has been so well received and so praised. And criticism naturally comes from more directions the higher up you go, right? And people have said, well, because Jordan's folks and his team had input into it, there was other stuff that could have been delved into more. Did you run into a lot of stop signs, don't go here, in the editorial process?
I ran into zero stop signs during the editorial process. So when that criticism comes, it comes from one or two sources, and then I think it becomes kind of in vogue to maybe adopt that and look at the doc through the lens of, well, this is what Michael wanted to say. Michael was involved, but on a distant satellite level in the making of this documentary. He never came close to the edit room. He only was seeing cuts when they were really just about to go on the air, just more out of curiosity than editorial control. I think Michael is above the fray when it comes to caring about how polished his image is and what he wants in there and what he wants out. And to the critics, I would say, we addressed all the stories that I hoped that we would address when we embarked on this 4 years ago. We did the accusations of Michael's gambling. We did the death of his dad. We did the conspiracies that surrounded his dad's death and his leaving for baseball. We did the criticisms that Michael has received of being a really harsh teammate. There's a lot of things we got into here. We got into the Republicans Buy Sneakers 2 thing. There's a lot of things that we got into here that I haven't seen him speak on the record about yet, and I'm proud of the stories that we told.
I thought it was great. I loved every second of it. And maybe you guys connected because of your great Williams College baseball career. Maybe that's where the real connection between you and Michael came up.
He has an affinity.
A lot of our folks at NBC.
He has an affinity for lefties who throw in the high 70s. I think that was it.
A lot of our folks behind the scenes at NBC are Williams College alums, and I know a lot of them are proud of your work as well. And it was really cool to watch, and especially at the time that it all hit. I know it was a lot of years and a lot of hours of work, and a shout out to you, man. Well done. And thanks for joining us here today, Jason. We'll look forward to catching up with you down the road.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Jason Hare joining us, the director of The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary. All right, what is the deal with baseball? How close are we? Jim Salisbury covers it on a regular basis for NBC Sports Philadelphia. Maybe some baseball news for you when we come back. I mean, who doesn't like breakfast for dinner every once in a while? A little breakfast at Wimbledon for you. Venus and Serena, the 2003 ladies' finals. The gentlemen's final with Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe and Sampras Agassi. Some great ones. NBCSN, as we go to NBC Sports Vault for your entertainment from the All England Club tonight here on NBCSN. Jim Salisbury is NBC Sports Philadelphia's Phillies insider. He joins us for a couple of minutes as we wrap up the hour and the conversation about baseball's return. And Jim, first off, what hat are you rocking here? Who are we giving a shout out to?
Well, these days, Mike, I'm rocking any hat I can get my hands on because I've gone through about three haircut cycles, so I am pretty shaggy. And I'm in need of like a driveway haircut. Maybe somebody will have a pop-up. But yeah, this is the local Little League from Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. Down here in the southeastern corner of Pennsylvania. So it's kind of got a sharp look to it. So we were rocking this one today.
Every Little League needs a shout out too, especially covering up a haircut. Good on you.
I can only imagine how much these kids must be missing Little League. I mean, when I was in elementary school, I used to stare out the window all day if I had a Little League game. And when it would rain, I would be in such a bad mood. These poor kids, no Little League this year.
Yep. I think the kids are feeling that for sure. That youth sports aspect of the summer is going to be missed out on by a lot. So what do you read to MLB's safety protocols that they have put out there as we start to look at some sort of a framework for baseball returning maybe on the 4th of July?
Yeah, I mean, 67 pages, certainly very detailed, covering everything from, you know, your stay in hotels to how you can travel to the ballpark with your teammates, no Uber. No showering. I mean, they're recommending no showering after games. You know, I think of some of these pitchers who love to do the hot and cold compresses, hot and cold whirlpools, the contrast whirlpools after games. I guess they wouldn't be able to do that. Mm-hmm. The distancing in the dugout, sitting in the stands, can't talk to the third base coach. throwing out balls after you use them and touch them. It's going to be, I think, you know, baseball players are really creatures of routine and creatures of habit. I mean, they spit a lot. They don't even know they're spitting. It's in their subconscious. It's in their ball player DNA. Things like that are going to be very, very difficult for these guys to break, chewing sunflower seeds in the outfield. I just wonder, you know, how this stuff is going to be policed. And is there going to be a punishment if you do stuff like this? So very detailed. Health and safety has to be the first priority here. And it still is. And once they can come to an agreement on how they're going to enforce this stuff and if the players are going to buy into it, it's not going to be too difficult to embrace, then they have to move on to the financial part of it. But I still think there's going to be some baseball this summer. I think it's very, very dangerous for the sport and the industry to just vanish for a year and a half.
Yeah, it is. No mascots as well was in that. That means no Philly Fanatic. If it was hockey and there was no Gritty, that would be a no-go for me. But that this is another story. We only have a minute left. The financial is the big one that you just mentioned. Do you think that's a bridge that they can go, the gulf that they can bridge, I should say, between the players and the players' union and the teams?
I do, Mike, and here's why. Usually when these two sides, these old warring factions, the owners and the players get together and start talking about money, you know, they draw lines, they dig in, there's rancor early, and they eventually work their way to the middle. One of the things with this coronavirus, you know, crisis, the shutdown, is you notice there's a real sense of community out there. See it in your neighborhoods, in your town, with people. Baseball needs to show that same sense of community. The owners and the players, they need to come together. And if health and safety can be worked out, they need to figure out a way to work out those finances and play some ball. Because, like I said, come together, show some community, get back there on the field, if and only if it's going to be safe for everyone.
10 seconds. Do you think we see baseball 4th of July in the cities, like in Philly, in New York, in those places?
I hope so, and I hope we see it right here in Philadelphia. What better place to go on the 4th of July?
That'd be pretty cool. Jim, thank you. Jim Salisbury, our NBC Sports Philadelphia Phillies insider. We appreciate the time.
Thanks, Mike.
And a little shout-out for the Little League down there as well. Rich Eisen has, not standing next to each other, but Shaquille O'Neal and Andrea Kramer coming up on his show. If you missed any of our show, we re-air at 3 Eastern time. Unless you're watching us in the re-air window, but it's available on our NBC Sports YouTube channel and, of course, our podcast. We will see you right back here tomorrow for Lunch Talk Live, the Rich Eisen Show next on NBCSN. Enjoy.